Good morning. Let me see. Yeah. All right. First try. Hot dog. So today we're going to talk about some apologetic stuff, but I have a confession to make up front. I got so into it that I didn't sleep last night, and I wrote a lesson that is two sermons long, so we're only going to do half of it. I'm very tired, but very happy. If any of this apologetic stuff is secondary to what you need right now, then let me start with this. God loves you. He loves you so much. And He loves you more than I'm going to be able to tell you in the next lesson alone. But just put that in the box right now and let that settle in. I was planning to do three stages of apologetics for you. Philosophy, an example of apologetic philosophy. An example of how to come back with data from science, with biblical studies, and some archaeology stuff. We are going to try to do the first two. Now, when it comes to what we will do this morning, nothing is more important than the text of Genesis 1. This is my translation. Follow along with the translation that you brought with you on your phone or in your lap or however you have it. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the earth existed waste and void, and darkness was over the face of the abyss, but the Spirit of God was roving over the face of the water. Then God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. So God distinguished between the light and the darkness. Then God named the light day, and He named the darkness night. Then there was evening. Then there was morning, one day. Then God said, "Let there be an expanse between the water, and let it distinguish water from water." So God made the expanse and distinguished between the water under the expanse and the water over the expanse. Then it was so. Then God called the expanse sky. Then there was evening. Then there was morning, a second day. Then God said, "Let the water under the sky be gathered to one place and let dry land appear." Then it was so. Then God named the dry land earth or land. And the gathered water He named seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the land cause the sprouting of vegetation, plant yielding like seed, tree, fruit making fruit after its kind with seed in it upon the earth." And then it was so. So the earth was set to produce vegetation, plant yielding like seed according to its kind, and tree making fruit with seed in it according to its kind. Then God saw that it was good. Then there was evening, then there was morning, a third day. Then God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to distinguish between the day and the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years, and let them be for lights in the expanse of the sky to shine upon the earth." Then it was so. So God made the two great lights, the greater light for dominion of the day and the lesser light for dominion of the night, and the stars. So God placed them in the expanse of the sky to shine upon the earth and to have dominion in the day and in the night and to distinguish between the light and the darkness. And God saw that it was good. Then there was evening, then there was morning, a fourth day. It's getting exciting now. Buckle up. Then God said, "Let the water swarm with a swarm of living creatures and let flyers," because there's not always different Hebrew words for all the things that fly, so I just translated it literally. And let flyers fly over the earth across the face of the expanse of the sky. So God created the great sea serpents and every living creeping creature that swarms the water according to their kinds, and every winged flyer according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then he enriched them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the water in the seas and let the flyer multiply on the earth. Then there was evening, then there was morning, a fifth day. Then God said, let the earth bring forth a living creature to according to its kind, beast and creeper and creature of the earth according to its kind. Then it was so. So God made the creature of the earth according to its kind, and the beast according to its kind, and every creeper of the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make humanity in our image, according to our likeness, so they may rule over fish of the sea and over flyer of the sky and over the beast and over all the earth and over every creature creeping upon the earth. So God created humanity in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. Then God enriched them. Then God said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over fish of the sea and over flyer of the sky and over every creature creeping upon the earth. Then God said, behold, I give to you every plant producing seed that's upon the face of all the earth, and every tree in which the fruit of the tree produces seed. Let it be food for you, and to every creature upon the earth, and to every flyer of the sky, and every creeper upon the earth in which is the breath of life, every green plant for food. Then it was so, and God saw all that he'd made, and behold, it was very good. Then there was evening, then there was morning, a sixth day, and then there's an inconvenient, unoriginal chapter division that actually cuts off the coda that matches the first line of Genesis 1:1. So I've put them together for you on the side so you can see the structure. Then the heavens and the earth were completed, and all the host of them. So God completed by the seventh day his work that he had done. So he desisted by the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God enriched the seventh day and consecrated it, because by it he had desisted from all his work that he had creatively done. This is God's story to us. Now, we have our own story nowadays. It goes something like this. The modern Western origin story is variations of, here's a universe that's expanding, it might contract too. There was a singularity that exploded into matter in the universe, and some of that matter eventually formed the earth and life upon it, changing drastically over sufficiently long periods of time into what we observe today. That's the gist. Now, in his story and our story, the cosmos, as we know them, have a beginning. Efforts to model the beginning of the universe without God have happened and have varied. It was suggested along the way that our universe has an eternal pattern in which it's expanding and contracting and could have recovered from a previous collapse with a Big Bang, a theoretical explosive event whose details are occasionally revised and new details are put forward and new arguments are made. It's also been argued along the way that the Big Bang's parent situation was rather a black hole, and it just got so energized that it couldn't come in anymore and it just exploded out. So fundamentally, an atheistic approach to our universe and everything in it depends upon an impersonal cycle or event, either eternal or inevitable. Now, my most recent resources on these matters only date to 2003, which isn't terrible, but there are probably some new big ideas out there that I failed to mention. I presume that these atheistic ideas are well thought out and that the people affirming them are generally well-intentioned, and that they are concerned about intellectual honesty and consistency. But the atheistic ideas I've mentioned and the ones I haven't will all have one issue in common. They are pigeonholed into one discipline. They run afoul of the demands of other disciplines. One of them is philosophy. Here comes the first example. This is how philosophy can work in apologetics. And I think it's one that you might be able to hold on to. It's like an attempt at a pocket-sized version. Now, philosophy's demands of cosmology matter because the truth, like the whole truth, cannot be found through mutual disregard between disciplines. Right? When we send our kids to school, we really hope they pay attention in more than one class. Because in a well-rounded approach to a view of life, you need more than one kind of set of information. This happens to be true as well of universal truth. So we've got some physics, and we've got some astronomy, and we've got some mathematics going on. But I'll give you an example as to how they fall short of philosophy. The Catholic apologist Hans Küng, as I understand him, acknowledges that there is a lot of room for uncertainty about our universe. Any individual person has the right to think about the universe as a whole and wonder about some stuff. This is a perfectly reasonable thing. But Küng argues that denying the existence of the meaningful sovereign person we can call God results in the concept of reality itself not just including uncertainties, but being entirely untrustworthy. The only person, Küng argues, who would be intellectually safe is a person who trusts absolutely nothing. A nihilist, we call them, which people can't maintain in practice. And we're going to go into that. How does he come to this inescapable conclusion? He challenges us with two choices. First choice, is there any room for trust in reality or not? Is there any room for trust in reality or not? Küng argues that either the universe is a home for humanity full of meaning and value, or it is a sheer happenstance devoid of any transcendent purpose. If we choose answer B, I didn't even need the laser beam. I put a circle up there, and I just too sleepy. I forgot. If we choose B, then we are by definition nihilists. But nihilism, believing that nothing, putting trust in nothing, nihilism provides no ground for aesthetics or ethics. And those are two things on which people consistently demand. We insist in a rather universal way on evaluating the worth of things based on their appeal to us, or what we don't like about them, or on whether we feel that something is right or wrong. Just please try to find one person, and if you find one, try to find five people who really operate in daily life without having any concern about whether or not something is appealing to them or not, or whether or not they have any concept of right and wrong. But if we choose this, we are saying that all of those feelings, all of that intuition should be entirely misplaced and bound and foundless. But because with nihilism, everything is meaningless. Everything. It makes as much difference to go and buy a bottle of orange juice as it does to go and kill 30 people. It makes no difference. Most people, however, again, can't live like that. Don't live like that. Even your average atheist does not live like that. And they find, by default then, they must concede, that fundamental trust in answer A is the compelling option. That is, people insist on having room to trust something or another beyond themselves. So human nature, in practice, answers A, just by observation. And then there's Kuhn's second choice. If we opt for fundamental trust, if we chose A on the last question, then we have another choice to make. Uncertain reality is uncertain reality either has a ground and source that overcomes absolute uncertainty, otherwise you just go into a circle to nothing being untrustworthy, see question A. Uncertain reality either has a ground or source behind it that overcomes absolute uncertainty, or it does not. It is either ruled, the universe that we can't entirely be certain about as individual people, either is ruled by a divine providence or it is ruled by chance. Now you get to make the choice. The choice is yours, all yours to make. You can type it down in your phone if you want to remind yourself. You can write it on your calendar. You can just think it. The choice is yours. But the choice to believe that reality is ruled by a personal, transcendent, immanent God turns out to be rationally justified because it provides a grounds and support for fundamental trust. And atheism does not. Atheism, then, or anything that is built on atheism, even a scientific cosmological argument about math and astronomy and physics, anything that ultimately is used to try to argue, this is why, in the end, this is why you shouldn't believe in God. It rejects the supernatural and remodels the natural. It does those things. Every atheistic argument does those things. But it does so by ignoring our own nature that we see in each other every day, Christian or not. People live like there's a God and have forever. And any argument in which one of those people that lives as if there's a God behind the universe that simply says, nuh-uh, has not made an effective and compelling case. Does that make sense? This means yes, and this means no, and this means I lost you. So, I mean, does that make sense? Okay, good. Okay, good. Now, I think we have time. Oh, I have 5 minutes. This is terrible. I think we have time. Did I show you that slide? I did now. So there you go. His story and our story. The Bible consistently advertises, in contrast to mainstream atheistic arguments, the Bible, which is a lot older, consistently advertises the cosmos and all its features as the creative work of an eternal person. Not just an eternal or inevitable thing, but a force capable of giving purpose, a force capable of being trustworthy. of validating the human instinct to trust. And it handles the practical demands of philosophy better. And in terms of science, it can handle science just as well. I have some confidence that the Bible only conflicts with science when we're making unnecessary assumptions, incomplete observations, or we're handling the Bible poorly. Now, we won't get into all the reasons why humans are motivated to resist the Bible's particular proposition about God's eternal, inevitable sovereignty over the origin of the universe, though it's worth saying that Christians behaving badly has been a major factor in the history of intellectual thought. But there is a sense in which hundreds of years of human scientific effort have served a decisive push for humans to look at the Bible and say, I just don't want to go along with that. And on a certain level, faced with a reasonable uncertainty faced with a reasonable necessity for something eternal or inevitable behind the universe we know and love, humans have put work into replacing our acceptance of a long advertised God with ideas about the universe itself, which is really sad when you think about it. 2,000 years later, we humans are still guilty of Paul's observation in Romans 1 that we have a history of putting creation before creator. Ain't nothing changed in terms of human instinct and intellectual behavior. Ain't nothing changed. Now, what if we just try to believe both, right? 100% Bible and 100% evolution or any particular model that seems to serve an atheistic purpose. Can we just shove them together and be fine? It has proven appealing to a wide Christian audience to read the Big Bang and more of evolutionary theory into the text of Genesis. But I would caution that this has not been done well enough to be reasonable. The top advocates for these inferences are, in my experience, specialists in scientific fields who have made the common error of not being sufficiently informed by specialists in the biblical text. Scientists have often complained, and quite publicly, and not without justification, that people try to use the Bible to curate science without approaching science properly. You have heard this accusation. Well, it causes just as many problems when scientists don't approach the biblical text properly as they try to make the Bible unproblematic to modern scientific theories. In a big way, this comes down to doing eisegesis, which is reading meaning into a text, over exegesis, which is determining the meaning of a text based on its own context and content. I would like to introduce you to the tale of Procrustes. He is a figure from Greek mythology, and he was not a nice man. Theseus slew Demastes, whom some call Procrustes. He had his dwelling beside the road and made up two beds, one small and the other big. And offering hospitality to the passersby, he laid the short men on the big bed and hammered them to make them fit the bed, but the tall men he laid on the little bed and sawed off the portions of the body that projected beyond it. In case you haven't been paying attention to the last 300 years of human thought, this is what we do with ideas that we don't like. This is what we do with propositions that we are uncomfortable with. We will get a little information and we will stretch it, or we will cut off the parts that we don't like to make it fit the bed of the idea. And truth and honesty is our thesis. Let him come and kill. We must let that kind of behavior die. Now, if you want to do this, if you want to shove it together, my advice to you is that you must do it better. I'm not going to try to stop you from trying, but you've got to do better. And I'm going to give you some tips on how. Important exegetical things to keep in mind for Genesis 1. It is not written to us first And it is not written to us alone. It is written for the understanding of the original audience before ours. And I'll give you an example. How many of you have ever heard the idea that the days in Genesis 1 that we read explicitly, word for word, should be interpreted as millions or billions of years? You've heard that. I see some nods. Here's the issue with that. You will never, ever go into a Hebrew class at any university. Notre Dame. I'm not talking about Freda Hartman or Lipscomb or something like that. I'm talking about Notre Dame or UC Berkeley or Harvard. You will not go into a Hebrew class and have any professor tell you that they have any reason based on Hebrew literature for ancient people to have read that word and go, man, never counted to a million before. Never met anybody who has. What is that one? Because the number million did not conceptually exist in the ancient world. The math stopped at multiples of 10,000. Like they didn't do it. It literally can't work that way in Hebrew. Now, another thing. And this is where the tie is important. Behold the tie, okay? It informs a late Bronze Age cosmology, a late Bronze Age understanding of the universe. And that is why my tie is wrong. Not the textual quote, but the background. We have lived, anybody that was born since Sputnik went up has grown up, no. Is that the bell for you to stop? Are you calling me out? Is it time? Can I keep going? Okay. All right. Buckle up. We're going to go fast now. So, everyone in this room has grown up on pictures of outer space. Every single person. We are used to the world brought to us by NASA. The moonshot with the half earth and the silhouette, all of them. And how many of you, when you have envisioned Genesis 1:1, have done so, compliments of NASA? You are thinking about things appearing in outer space, and you're like, bam, all of a sudden there's this beam of light in a massive dark universe. You got to lay that to rest, folks. Genesis 1 did not have NASA. There are no photographs from outer space. It has what we call, Genesis 1 is written fundamentally with what we would call an earthbound viewshed. A viewshed is the technical term for what you can see, the range, the field of vision that you have. I'll give you an example. When God said, let there be light, days before he created the sun and the moon and the stars, this has caused such a wild kerfuffle in Christian, like, scientific discussion versus atheistic discussion. It's like, how could there be light if the sun's not there? Look, every single day of your lives, you have all experienced an earthbound viewshed equivalent of Genesis 1. Ever heard of dusk? Ever heard of dawn? Like, when the Bible, when Genesis 1, in Slate Bronze Age cosmology, says God made light, what he is prompting the original audience to visualize is not a photo from 1979 by the lunar lamp. It is light without anything in the sky. And then there's darkness without anything in the sky. And then there's light again without anything in the sky. You literally, if it's a cloudy morning, you literally have done that so many times in your life. And this is fun, and this is important, because what it does mean is that Genesis 1 does not make a claim as to how they experienced it. But it does say what they would have experienced if they were there. And then, it is anti-chaotic and anti-competitive in nature. Fundamentally, the word for abyss is actually very, very close to the ancient Babylonian word for the primordial god of the sea, Tiamat. The Babylonian creation story is older than Genesis. Okay? It's not older than the universe. It's not older than truth. But it is older than the document that we call Genesis that was written in the late Bronze Age. In the Enuma Elish, the Babylonian creation epic, there is a war between Tiamat, the primordial deep, and one of her kids. And ultimately, he rips her apart into multiple pieces, and all her the pieces of her corpse become different elements of the body. This is fundamental to the way that all ancient people pretty much looked at the world. When you go outside, you see opposing forces. You understand heat and cold. You understand dark and light. You understand summer and winter. You understand a world that pushes back against its different parts and pushes around in cycles. The way that ancient people explained that was cosmic warfare. And the way that ancient people explained the origin of all that was the beginning of cosmic warfare. And there is none of that nonsense in Genesis 1. There is no fighting. There is no war. There is God in divine providence simply saying, this is it. And that's it. Given what we've covered about philosophy already, it is interesting to consider that evolutionary theory is fundamentally chaotic in nature. It is all about the rules of natural selection. In fact, Stephen Hawking, arguing for an origin to gravity and other forces of the universe, argued that the forces of the universe themselves that are now so stable are the winners of an unknown process of natural selection on a physics level. Chaos, winner take all. Even our modern evolutionary theories are a fundamentally different character that is opposed to the fundamental character of Genesis 1. Take that into account. That's all I'm asking. Just take it into account. That's all I'm asking. And it's not poetry, and it's not scientific. A lot of our scientific discussions about Genesis 1 pertain to what type of literature it was in its day. That's a good example of an exegetical question. That's a good question. What type of literature is Genesis 1? And various degrees of the argument have been made that if Genesis 1 was just a poem, it is scientifically irrelevant. It has also been argued in different fashions that Genesis 1 is not poetry, but God intentionally worded it in such a way that it's in keeping with the physical realities that we would eventually be able to discover scientifically, and it names them. Like it drops hints for 21st century people, and those poor backwards ancient Israelites just weren't up to snuff, and they missed it. But we get it. No! Oh my word, it was not written to us first. Both of these are insufficient eisegetical responses to the great exegetical question of the literary genre of Genesis 1. First of all, Genesis 1 is not a poem. And I don't mean that by our standards of poetry. I mean that by Hebrew standards of poetry. There is a discussion to be had about how ancient people wrote poetry in the late Bronze Age and early Iron Age, and Genesis 1 does not feature prominently in that discussion. It is not like a poem. Genesis 1 was also clearly not written to convey the processes of creation in terms of physics, astronomy, mathematics, chemistry, hydrology, geology, or biology. Otherwise, Genesis 1 would be a lot longer, and God would have also set up a publishing company instead of a tree in the middle of the garden to charge Adam and Eve for the textbook. And when Cain and Abel came along, that very crafty serpent in charge of the publishing company would have changed the cover, added one new picture and one new paragraph, and told them to buy the whole set over again, and Adam and Eve would have called the publishing company and told the serpent that they were homeschooling their kids and they just needed a teacher's copy. And the serpent would have told them that that's not an option. But he would be happy to include a teacher's copy if they bought four copies of the second edition, and Adam would have invented the first curse words, and then the fall of man would have happened anyway. And that is a great example of eisegesis, right? I have given you a model that pulls from the text, but isn't actually based in the text. You get it? Now, it is very important to note that Genesis 1 is artful, even if it is not a poem. It is beautifully worded, even provocatively worded in a sense, like I told you. There are some plays on words in Hebrew. But this is where the Christian apologist sniffing out wording in the Bible that seems prescient to our scientific endeavors today should be very cautious. The wording in Genesis 1 must be considered primarily from the perspective of what its original audience could perceive from their view shed on the surface of the earth, because that was the extent of their ability to view this planet and outer space. And there's no part of Genesis 1 that wasn't written for them first. Given that, I'll give you two examples. A modern discussion of the world being formless, right? And there being a watery abyss could be today about physics and chemistry and a body of water appearing in space. But, and this is an actual picture that is for sale online as a teaching tool for that verse, the earth was formless and void. I don't remember the price. It wasn't bad. It was single digits. But, from the perspective of the original audience, it's more probable that the word formless, waste and empty, formless and void, activated the sensory imagination of it being so dark that you can't make out shapes, or what it's like to look out to the sea on the night of a new moon and a cloudy sky without any land visible in the distance, or even what it's like to be alone in the desert. In fact, the same Hebrew word is used in Deuteronomy 32:10 to visualize the patriarch Jacob alone in a windy desert. And this picture, which is not a blank screen, it is a picture, is a snapshot of a video on YouTube taken from the deck of a cruise ship in 2021 out on the open ocean at night during a thunderstorm. Formless and void. Earthbound version. As another example, our modern translations of Genesis 1, 6 through 7 use words that indicate space in between the waters on the surface of the earth and the waters above. Now, it's a pretty popular point in Christian apologetics that we can scientifically model how there used to be a water envelope around the planet in the atmosphere. And I don't necessarily take issue with that if it's a reasonable model, but it's important to acknowledge that Genesis 1 was not obviously written to convey that in the same way to the ancient Hebrews and to us, and they just didn't have the means to understand like we do now. Oh, nay, nay. It was written for them first. In its context, Genesis 1 explaining the world from their viewshed, the waters above would have more probably referred to the experience and basis of for precipitation. And then there's the word rakia. This word appears in Genesis 1, Psalm 19, Psalm 150, a couple chapters in Ezekiel, Daniel 12. It was only ever used in the Bible to refer to the one thing to which it refers here in Genesis. And that thing is the thing that God made to enact a functional separation between waters he wants below and waters he wants above. Now, the words we tend to use today to translate rakia are motivated by our understanding of airspace. So we use terms like expanse in English, and that's not wrong, because it is talking about that. In earlier English translations, we borrowed an old French word, firmament, which came from the Latin word firmamentum, which just means something fixed in place. So they kind of sidestepped the issue of what it was. And that's also not bad. But did Genesis 1, in its original language and to its original audience, verbally portray that God fixed a pocket of open airspace between the seas and an atmospheric planetary canopy of water? Should we convey to others, that's precisely what Genesis says? Maybe just take a little bit of a chill pill on that. Just a smidge. At least not without a little more clarification, and I'll give you that clarification, because an exegetical translation of the Hebrew noun rakia would be vault rather than expanse or firmament. And I don't mean a vault like a safe. No, I mean a vault like an architectural design. A vault like, oh, my notes moved, and now I'm lost. There we go. A vault in a ceiling design, like a high arched ceiling in a building. God seems to have conveyed what he put between the waters below and the waters above by using the briefest reference to an architectural idea in the text of Genesis 1, so that they could comprehend it by analogy. Because from an earthbound viewshed, they perceived everything above them as we do, from inside a dome. Which is why this image from a contemporary webpage on learning astronomy and this illustration of how people used to model the entire universe are essentially shaped the same. It's because modern-day astronomy and ancient cosmology are both based solely on what you could see and imagine beyond it. You see it, right? Like, you see it's the same shape. It's right there. You see it, right? Right? Okay, good. So, here we go. Genesis 1, 6 through 7 portrays God making the dome shape we can all perceive above us. That's what the word is for in the text. And its stated purpose is the enforcement of God wanting water there. So, Genesis 1 isn't poetry, and it's not scientific. So what is it? Well, it is explanatory. There's a lot that it doesn't explain, but what it does explain, it tries hard to do. It uses analogy. It has a thoughtfulness for its audience's perspective, and it uses some Hebrew terms that we've discussed that were meant to explain away even paganism ideas. I would also maintain that it is narrative. Narrative literature, as opposed to poetry, by definition, functions to tell something in a manner that appeals to our mental sense of things having happened, right? Now, can a narrative be fictional? In general, sure. Even ancient people were capable of distinguishing between a story about something that didn't really happen, that might even have a good point to it, and a story about something they understood as having really happened. Ancient people were able to make that distinction just as much as we are. But that said, the ancient world thought as seriously about cosmological origins as we do today. People don't write books and include it in middle school chapters of science books because we don't care about where everything came from. We really do. And they deserve the credit of feeling the same. They actually really cared where things all came from. And it is not in keeping with good historical thinking to imagine that the Israelites looked at Genesis 1, the singular cosmological account cherished by their people for centuries, as a fiction with some vague theological moral, leaving themselves without Genesis 1 with either paganism or some made-up secularism that we assign them to give themselves no good answers. The ancient Hebrews did not want to settle for having no answers about where everything came from. They wanted to know. And this was the answer for them. It is a factual narrative that the Israelites were meant to understand to the best of their ability to comprehend it. And this factual but very accommodating cosmological narrative also has a very notable literary structure. And the focus of that structure isn't what God made. What God made is presented broadly and in very brief terms. What the structure highlights is God's creative timing. Genesis 1 emphasizes repeatedly that God created all he did in terms of days, like it repeats the point seven times. Okay? If the point of Genesis 1 was primarily that God made everything, if that was supposed to be the big takeaway, then how long it took is irrelevant. Nor is it obvious that the intended takeaway was, oh man, look how fast he did it all, which is often what gets highlighted when we're trying to argue with evolutionists about theorized eons of evolution. But that fight didn't exist in the late Bronze Age. So the ultimate point, the point of the structure is not just God made everything. And the point of the structure is not, look how fast he did it. The distinguishing punctuation of each day at a time is savoring it. And I would like to suggest to you that Genesis 1 offers creation in a calendar form. Now, this idea is not original to me. It's been published by a guy who studies the Bible as literature, Michael Lefevre. A calendar that was meant to serve not only as cosmological doctrine, this is where we know things came from, but as the basis for a theological approach to the weekly life of the ancient Israelites with whom God made a covenant after bringing them out of Egypt, because those people were the original audience of Genesis 1. Exodus 20, verses 8 through 11. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to Yahweh your God. You shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male or your female servant, or your cattle or your sojourner who stays with you. For in 6 days, Yahweh made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore, Yahweh blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Genesis 1 is the basis for one of the Ten Commandments. You realize that? Like it is meant to be soaked in on a weekly basis. And as a factual calendar narrative, believers today can then understand that the ancient Israelites did not invent this creation story to theologically enhance their work week. God, in his covenant with them, a God that we have a reasonable justification to believe in, instead insisted that their normal work week be structured with reference to what he did in the beginning, which he also conveyed and reinforced through the writing of Genesis 1, a calendrical, brief literary account. They didn't need all the details of his powerful creative work in which we have taken so much scientific interest. And neither they nor we are in a position to sort out everything that he did that week. But it does seem that he did want them to comprehend what existed by his power and to see their own days of work and Sabbath rest as a reflection of the very same days he spent creating until all was very good. I am done. Are you relieved? Do you need to go to the bathroom? Are you okay? Man. So I have two invitations for you tonight. The first one is that y'all who are coming back tonight, y'all got to make a choice. Because I wrote three lessons and only have time to present two. So you can either have part two of this tonight, or you can test me on the treatment of the role of women in the church. There you go. There's your choice. This is, you get to choose. The second invitation is to respond to the love of the God whom you have a very good reason to believe in and to trust. He loves you just so much. If he can love me, I promise you he can love you. My name is Scott. I am a sinner, and I have caused problems in the church with the things that I don't do right. I don't think I'm alone. So, if you have something that you want to pray about besides me and my poor heart, then you can let us know while we stand and sing.